Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity Books. My name is George Miller, and my guest in this programme is John Agar. John is Senior Lecturer in Science and Technology Studies at University College London. He's also the editor of the British Journal for the History of Science, and his previous publications include histories of the computer and the mobile phone. John Agar's new history of science in the 20th century and beyond goes beyond the limitations of disciplinary and national histories of science to look at the broad themes in the science of the last 11 decades. He shows the close connections between science and warfare, politics and the commercial world, and charts the rise of new fields and the impact of new discoveries. He also tells the stories of some of the remarkable individuals, both well-known and less familiar, who shaped 20th century science. When we met recently, I began by asking John if this project had taken him down many byways of 20th century science he had not previously visited.
Yes, that's true, because I suppose the history I knew most about before was the history of the physical sciences and topics like the history of radio astronomy and history of computing, whereas what I wanted to do was write a history of all of science in the 20th century, and of course that includes a lot of life sciences. You know, biology is extremely exciting, there's molecular biology, there's ecology, environmental sciences, and those ones I knew less well. Mm. So it's been a lot of research as well as a lot of telling people about things they already know.
and areas like psychoanalysis and psychology.
Yes, that's right. So the whole theories of the mind, all different kinds. How do you measure the mind? How do you measure intelligence? How do you cure people who've got mental problems? All those sorts of things have developed in extraordinary ways in the 20th century as well.
Now, when you set out, you knew you didn't want to write simply a sequence of disciplinary studies or a series of national studies. So how did you go about working out the best way to tackle this very big, ramified story?
It was a definite choice of mine right at the beginning that I didn't want to say, here's the history of astronomy, here's the history of physics, here's the history of biology, partly because those disciplinary histories have been told to some extent. I mean, if you're an astronomer, you know, actually, because it's part of your training, that in the past there was people like Copernicus and Newton, and then you have people like Edwin Hubble in the 20th century and the idea of the expanding universe, and now we have all kinds of different astronomies like X-ray astronomy and radio astronomy and all those. So different disciplines sort of tell their own history. What they don't often see is the connections between them. So, and one of the very interesting things about 20th century science is that a lot of the really exciting stuff has happened at the edges of disciplines. So, for example, a subject like molecular biology, the study of how very large molecules are very important for living processes and cells. That's as much chemistry as it is biology, and it relies on the techniques of physics. So it's a subject that you can only get a grasp of if you get an understanding of three very different, very important disciplines. So I was determined to write a book to get a sense of how science changes in the 20th century by looking at interconnections between disciplines. And then there was the thing about, well, how do you tell a global story? Because I wanted to not just tell a national story. Again, partly because we know we get told national stories. So there are heroes of British science, for example, that people know. But people may not know the heroes of Russian science or Australian science or Indian science. So what I wanted to do was make sure that there was a good mixture of national stories. And also that makes sense for science. I mean, science is an enterprise that does try to go beyond national boundaries. It aims to produce universal knowledge, I suppose, rather than working particularly in different countries. So national stories wasn't going to work. So then the question was, how do I divide up this book? How do I tell a coherent and interesting and exciting story, do it justice, without falling into the trap of saying, here's what happened in United States, here's what happened in Germany, and so on. And it can be done, and the trick I found was to look out for, in different times during the 20th century, there has been themes that have come out. And by exploring those themes, you can tie together disciplines and you can tie together the contributions of different countries.
And did you have a sense of what the big picture was likely to be when you started out, or was that something which emerged when you sort of were able to step back from the canvas?
This is something that surprised me. I thought I knew the science in the 20th century to some degree, but there are several things that surprised me whilst writing, whilst putting it together. And I suppose it's partly, once you try and paint a picture on this scale of canvas, you start to see, or you can draw or paint a different sort of picture, and you only find that out in actually doing it. So, for example, the extent to which the rise and importance of American science, now I knew American science was important, but the more I looked at the 20th century, the more I realised that actually here is something that is a historical phenomenon. I mean, there's no doubt if you count anything from number of Nobel Prizes or particular important developments, well, you know, in the 20th century, certainly by mid-century, it's American science that is really exciting. Well, how do you then explain that? So both, there are two jobs really. One is to describe what's going on, but then to try and make sense of it as well. And I found that was a question that, well, historians hadn't actually properly asked before, partly because we deal with much smaller case studies or national stories. If you paint on a bigger canvas, you end up with a different sort of picture.
Take us back to the year 1900, where your story begins, and just say a little bit about the state of science then, both as an institution, a practice, and also as insofar as its content was concerned, because what your book brings home is it's a very long way away in terms of our understanding of our world.
Yes, 1900 turns out to be quite a good place to start, although the science of 1900 is different as well as similar to what we have now. It was a smaller scale enterprise, so physics experiments tend to be of a sort of laboratory desk scale, for example. The electron had only been, in a sense, discovered for 3 years by 1900, because it was identified as such in 1897. New phenomena like radioactivity were the most exciting cutting-edge observations and discoveries of the day. It was a phenomenon that wasn't understood. You were still 5 years away from Einstein's special relativity papers and his other developments of 1905. So it got lots of things going on around the turn of the century in physics. In the life sciences too, you have a situation where Darwin's theory of evolution has been, you know, that was 40 years before, that was in 1859. But by 1900, you know, many scientists didn't believe Darwin's picture. So you have sort of the low point really of Darwinism in the late 19th century. Other theories of what could be driving variation and change in the living world. In astronomy, you have a situation where basically the picture is we live in one big galaxy, right? And it's a static picture. You know, we could see the night sky using just visual light, and the picture we had was of stars with a few nebula and things. And of course, in the 20th century, that's all going to change. You know, we now have a picture of an immense universe which is expanding away from us with all kinds of other strange phenomena like dark energy and dark matter, which no one had any inkling of in 1900. So the sciences were quite different around 1900, but it's also a good period of time to change, because it was just around then that, you know, many of the developments in modern physics and biology take off as well.
And you quote, I think it was a journalist saying around 1906, that there really is a gap opening up between the layperson, or the layman, as he said, layman's understanding of science and where science is really at. And I guess that is one of the trends that's going to continue as the story progresses in the 20th century. You know, you mentioned the sort of the laboratory bench experiment, and science, as it becomes more complicated, becomes more expensive, becomes more large scale, and no longer is the preserve of the single scientist working alone in the laboratory.
For sure. Science by 1900 was always already quite a specialised affair. You'd already got beyond the point where one person could understand it all. However, one person could probably conduct their own experiments, for example. And in the 20th century, you enter a period of much larger scale science, you know, where you might need hundreds or even thousands of scientists working together. And take, for example, the project to find the Higgs boson at CERN, for example. I mean, that involves thousands of people, thousands of scientists, engineers, instrument builders, all kinds of different people working together. That's like working in a very large organization, a very complicated one. And the science that comes out of it is very hard for people to understand. And I suppose was part of the challenge of writing a book on 20th century science as well, because I think the story is graspable and understandable and it's exciting, but it needed to be told in an accessible way, and also to show that why it's changed that way, and why do we have science that is so expensive and so large scale in its organisation now compared to 100 years ago.
Well, I was very struck right at the beginning of your story by the fact that the Curies working in Paris were not simply working in a theoretical sense, but also were very engaged in practical applications. It was like almost like a sort of chain from the Curies down to the final applications. And that is another theme which is going to persist throughout the book, isn't it? This connection between the science and how it gets applied in the real world.
Yes, this is one of my main conclusions, actually, and I was very pleased when it came together, because I wanted to find a way of explaining what motivates and what generates a lot of the science in the 20th century. And the concept that I introduce is the idea of a working world, which is the way the world sets up, throws up problems that need to be solved. They can't be solved directly because the world is such a messy, complicated place. So what scientists have been able to do is generate models of them on which they can theorize and experiment. And it means that science has always been very closely tied to the problems the world's thrown up. So even though we might have this image of the scientist as being an aloof figure, far away from the problems of everyday life, actually, I think they're actually very close. And even something like physics, for example, that the Curies were doing, which is on one level an investigation of a very strange, rare phenomenon of radioactivity. Well, to investigate it, they need to use the tools of industry. So, for example, recording it requires knowledge of how photography works, for example. But also, very quickly, they are developing applications. They are using radium, as soon as they can generate it in any amount of quantity, for medical purposes. Understanding and noticing its biological effects leads on to the question of, you can use it to affect the body, and therefore you can use it possibly to affect cures. So yeah, very quickly, radioactivity seems like an arcane science of the laboratory. It's actually very close to industry and medicine.
And the other example from early in the book, which sticks in my mind, is that of Einstein. And I think there's a conventional view of his work in the patents office as just being sort of the day job, as it were. But but you see a more interesting connection between his theoretical work and his patents work.
Yes, and this comes out of the work of our very best historians, who look at science in context and try and make sense of a figure like Einstein, who's tempting again to see as this sort of faraway, white-haired figure, very distant from everyday life. In fact, as historians like Peter Galison have shown, his work at the Patent Office is a perfect place to make sense of how do you use, for example, electrical equipment to display and record time simultaneously in different places. Because that's what urban centres in Europe around 1905 were trying to do. And those inventions were coming onto his patent desk, and he was reading them and he was thinking about them in very fundamental terms. So you can even give a good account of something like special relativity, which is one of the pinnacles of theoretical science, in the context of solving problems in cities.
I have long been fascinated by the figure of Fritz Haber, and he looms large in the first part of your book. I wondered if you could say something about Fritz Haber's career, because it seemed to me to touch on many of the big themes about science, both its applications in war, its polyvalency, its engagement with the real world, its high degree of implication in politics. I mean, maybe for people who don't know very much about Fritz Haber, you could just sort of sketch out how you see him touching the big themes of the story.
Yeah, so Haber was born into a Jewish family in 19th century Germany. And he's very much a German patriot as well. So when the First World War broke out, he was one of the people who signed the manifesto saying that, along with a lot of other German intellectuals, that science and knowledge should be at the service of the German nation and defending their war aims, for example. And you know, Haber is a fascinating figure, because not only do you have his wonderful work as a chemist, developing with industry the Haber-Bosch process, which fixes nitrogen from the air, gives us nitrates which could be used as fertilizers. Those fertilizers, by one estimate, end up allowing an extra 2 billion people to be fed in the 20th century. So you have an amazing contribution there. On the other hand, you have Haber, through pretty much the same connections and process and his knowledge of chemistry, developing sophisticated chemical weapons, overseeing their deployment, really, during the First World War with chlorine and the devastating consequences of that. So you have a tragic figure there, because you know he in a sense soars so high, but also you know, the consequences are so dramatically awful too. And then after the First World War, Haber is still a German patriot. One of the things he does, for example, is, because the Treaty of Versailles is saying Germany must pay all these reparations, he tries to find a way to extract gold from seawater to contribute to Germany again, to solve Germans' problems through chemistry again. And then with the rise of the Nazis, he's very ill, he's old by that stage, but he's essentially driven out of the country. And so you have in a cycle there, you have all some of the big themes of 20th century science, which is science in the service of warfare. There's no doubt that war, and the 20th century was afflicted by devastating wars, that war provides a context driving an awful lot of development in science, whether it's speeding up weapons, finding new ways of detecting aircraft like radar, and many of those have spin-off sciences of their own. So warfare is extremely important for understanding 20th century science. I mean, in a sense, unfortunately, but that is the pattern that you find. And a Haber is one figure that encapsulates that connection.
The other aspect that Haber makes me think of is the institutions in which science is practiced. He was head of one of Kaiser Wilhelm's many institutes, which were set up, I guess, deliberately in order to keep Germany ahead of the game.
Yes, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, which are now known as the Max Planck Institutes, were a distinctive German solution to the problem of international competition, really, an economic competition. The beginning of the century, around 1900, Britain had industrialized, probably the most furthest industrialized country on the planet. The United States was industrializing fast, and Germany, especially through the application of chemistry, was industrializing extremely quickly too. And around that time, that kind of competition for markets between industrial corporations was gathering pace and was one of the defining features of the geopolitical world. And the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes were there to channel sort of the creative applications of science and the connections between academic science and industry in a way that many other countries then followed that model. You know, many of those, the thought that you need to have science to understand and solve industrial problems, and it's from that your economy is going to grow. Well, I mean, that's the kind of world that we all live in now.
Science in the 20th century is continually throwing up moral issues, isn't it? Mm. And I thought what you wrote about research into chemical and biological warfare during the Second World War, yes, programs which were not implemented, although there were a lot of resource at a time when resource was scarce, was devoted to them. What was going on there, do you think? Not so much in the science, but in terms of the sort of application and the ethics of the science.
The weapon of mass destruction that everyone knows about from the Second World War, of course, is the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project, which was immensely expensive, required scaling up of laboratory physics to a huge scale. It's a good example of that process. It involved the heavy, crucial involvement of industry. So you have that science and industry connection, and led to a new weapon of war of devastating effect. So the atomic bomb. Everyone knows the outlines of that story, and of course it's extremely important. But during the Second World War II, the chemical and biological weapons were projects going on in different countries. So, for example, in Britain, there was projects to build anthrax weapons, which were tested. They were never used. And in the United States, you know, chemical warfare projects ended up involving, you know, well over a tenth of the chemists of the country. And you think, that's an awful lot of chemists. That's an awful lot of resources. Now, because they weren't used, they've kind of dropped out of history. But actually, they were significantly large projects of the Second World War with consequences as well.
Another very interesting thought that your book sparked in me was the whole idea of the missing history of science. That is to say, the science which is hidden from view, which is secret, which, you know, or the science which doesn't eventuate in anything, the science which looked promising for a time and then is aborted or goes nowhere. So it's almost as though, to use a cliche, that what we have is the tip of the iceberg, and yet there's this sort of huge mass of other science beneath the surface.
Yes, I tried to make a list of sort of missing stories at the end, partly to cover my back. I mean, there's an awful lot of science in the 20th century and you can't cover it all. So I was trying to think, well, what have I left out? And also, what are the stories that get routinely sort of undertold that are significant? And as a way of, I suppose, pointing out where, in a sense, more work is needed. So there's that sense of missing stories. But there's also, especially during the Cold War, there was a lot of science that was done under the cloak of secrecy. And we are only now finding out about some of that research. So some projects that only 20 years ago we thought of as being quite pure astronomical projects turn out to be half astronomy, half eavesdropping projects. There were projects that had secret sides, dark sides, as well as sort of bright sides. That's only becoming apparent as we're able to get into the archives and where they're released. We're telling new stories about science in the Cold War now just because we can document them, we can find out things, and we're finding out many interconnections that we didn't know before. And that's part of the process of history. I mean, history relies on getting access to documents and digging out stories. And then still there's aspects which I'm sure are significant, but we still don't know about. The very secret ends of the state, for example, to do with surveillance and eavesdropping, which is still very, very hard to uncover. I'm sure are very important for understanding the trajectories of history of computing, for example. We don't know the full history of artificial intelligence either because of the connections it has to very secret areas. For example, understanding translating natural language, for example, was very important during the Cold War. And those are stories that we're still uncovering, and more will come out.
You mentioned earlier that when you stood back from the canvas, one of the things you saw was the shift to the United States as a centre for science, or perhaps the centre for science. And I suppose if I'd been asked to give an explanation of that, I probably would have fallen back on what I think you might see as rather weak explanations, that it was an advanced economy, it was affluent, it was of a certain size, it was a brain drain from Europe in the 20s and 30s. But you think that's a little bit flimsy as an explanation?
I think I counted seven different possible explanations. And one of them is certainly that the United States, by the mid-20th century, was the wealthiest country in the world. But there's no reason why wealthy countries need science. So they have to choose to spend a lot of that wealth on science, and they set priorities within it. Now, one of those priorities, of course, is within areas of warfare. So the fact that, especially during the Cold War, which was a permanent mobilization of science, because you couldn't, once a war broken out, you can't then mobilize science, because war could be over in 3 minutes. So there was a permanent mobilization of physics and other branches of science, to the aid of building and keeping running different kinds of military systems. And that had, I think, lots of consequences for the sciences. So it was a rich country which felt that it needed to be permanently mobilized for warfare for much of the 20th century. That's one explanation that goes some way. It's also a very distinctive kind of country. It's a very big country. It relies on technological systems, for example, to get around or to communicate. And many sciences stem from getting technological systems to work. You know, from the early days of telegraphy and telephony or electrical supply systems is one. The sharing of computer resources over a place of scale of the United States. Well, in a sense, that gives us a context why things like the internet were developed in the United States. So there's some geographical factors in there too, and there are other reasons as well. I think it's one of the exciting open questions of history. Actually, is why did the United States become such a prolific country for science in the 20th century?
And the question of the shift from physics, crudely put, to biological sciences as where it's at, is that an easier shift to explain?
It's not easy to explain because I'm not even sure it's happened. It's one of those trends of the last 30 years that I thought I was certain about at the beginning of the book, and I'm less certain now. So the idea was that there has been a trend away from the physical sciences towards the life sciences, with the rise of biotechnology, for example. And I think there are very interesting things going on. For example, you know, if you look at America, things like the National Institutes of Health spend an awful lot of money on biomedical sciences. The Wellcome Trust in Britain and elsewhere spends an awful lot on the biomedical sciences. More money has gone into the life sciences through that route. But on the other hand, for every human genome project, you can find things like CERN, which are also of such a large scale, also use an awful lot of resources. So I think it's probably more the case, in fact, that science has continued to expand. And within that, there's been a big expansion of the life sciences. So physics maybe hasn't suffered, I think. I mean, at the end of the Cold War, there was a big worry that funds for physics would dry up. And there were worries about physics departments and chemistry departments shutting down. And people would look at rather jealously at the life sciences biology departments that were doing very well. And I think that was that actually is beginning to look like a sort of end of Cold War anxiety. That people thought that might be a trend that would continue. In fact, there's been no long-term swing from the physical to the life sciences, but there's no doubt that the life sciences have been very exciting places to be in the last 20 years.
And maybe where the focus of public debate is more than physics.
I think that's true. I think the life sciences, because they deal with the human body, for example, there's a lot of room for controversy there. So I suppose many of the controversial areas, whether they're talking about genetic modification of organisms or even talking about a case like BSE, you know, it's to do with food or human health. Those are areas which sit at fault lines, so it's more likely to be controversial or raise ethical problems. So I suppose there's always been, or at least recently, there's been a more of a debate around the life sciences because, you know, that's the kind of issues it throws up.
And at the end of the book, John, you try to look into the future a little bit. And I wondered if you saw China as a country which is still punching below its weight scientifically, but is rapidly rising up the scale.
Of course, there's a great danger of writing history right up to now. And I've tried to. I mean, the book is called Science in the 20th Century and Beyond. Mm. And I did want to have something to say about the sciences as they're developed in the new millennium. One of the trends, and it certainly draws attention of the journals like Nature and Science, who comment on, you know, ways where science going now. Well, you know, the rise of China and India, alongside the rise of economic powers, their proportion of money they're spending on science and the amount of money they're spending on science has increased. So they are coming superpowers in science. There's no doubt about it. There's locations in China and India where there's campuses, there's industrial connections, there's all the things that, if you look back in the 20th century, that's a situation that led to interesting science in Germany or in the United States or in Britain. So I think we could well expect China and India to be the places where Nobel Prizes are won routinely over the next 100 years.
And if I were to ask you finally a very unfair question and say, if we were to bury in a time capsule for 10 years, your prediction of where we would be in 2022, any predictions you'd be willing to make?
Okay, I'll make several predictions. You've put me on the spot here, but it's a very good question. I think we still don't understand the brain, that the current excitement about neuroscience techniques such as basically scanning the brain and making essentially psychological deductions from it is in fact more like phrenology of the 19th century, and the expectation that it might lead quite quickly to a full understanding of mind and brain, I think that is going to be dashed. Another easy prediction is we still won't be able to translate natural language by machine, because that has always seemed just around the corner. It never quite arrives. It turns out to be extremely difficult, and it's all about being human, and I don't think that's going to be a problem that's solved soon either. In physics and cosmology, I think we'll have the Higgs boson. I think that's shaping up quite nicely, but whether we find the physics beyond that and what that is, and whether we have the resources to investigate it, we might find that we get hints of what the physics to be might be, but it turns out to have a price tag we cannot afford. So physics may well stall at that point, because it's hard to see how the $10 trillion linear accelerator or something like it is going to be built. So physics might be in trouble. Cosmology and astronomy is an interesting one, because we have things like dark energy and dark matter, which are so strange, which if you looked at one way, you would think there's a science in crisis, because it can tell us there is well over half the universe that we just don't know what it is or what kind of stuff it is. We know it has some effect, but we just don't know anything about what it is. Well, you could stand back from that and say that science isn't doing very well. Actually, the opposite is true. It seems to be a very exciting science to be in at the moment, and possibly hints at what dark matter might be by 2020 or soon after. You know, I think that would be very exciting development. In the life sciences, a lot of the talk is about very cheap genomics. There's a $1,000 genome prize. Can you get a personal genome done for $1,000? If you can do that, then you can use it almost routinely in diagnostics. If you can do that, then we have personal genome-based health possibilities, which might still be very expensive. We might have to have arguments whether we can afford that on the NHS. I can see that coming up. We're in a very exciting period for natural history. Possibly by 2020, we might know what most of the species are on the planet.
Most of the remaining ones.
Yes, most of the remaining ones, because we are still finding species at pretty much the same rate. There are estimates of what the overall figure might be, but they vary immensely depending on who you might talk to. And so that's a basic question of, you know, what's on Earth?
And in terms of applications of science, do you think we'll have found the techno fixes to some of our environmental problems, not least climate change?
I don't think so, no. I think the geoengineering of various kinds, which are very large scale interventions into how the planet works, will have drawbacks of their own that are unanticipated. This seems to be the usual pattern for big projects like that, and they will also turn out to be more expensive than they are predicted to be. And since the alternative is a across the globe behavioural change, which sounds equally unlikely, I'm rather pessimistic on that front.
I was talking to John Agar about his new book, Science in the 20th Century and Beyond, which is out now. For more details, visit the Polity Books website at politybooks.com. That's all for this Polity podcast, but I'll be back again soon with more interviews with Polity authors. Do also look out for a growing number of videos on the Polity website. I hope you can join me again for our next podcast, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.